Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Happy MLK Jr. Day. This is The Takeaway from Monday, January 16th, 2017.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Thanks so much for listening on this holiday. You have got to love America, right? On the weekend that commemorates the sacred contributions of the civil rights movement to this country's heritage. A weekend to remember words and deeds that moved this nation forward from a time of racial hatred and violence and segregation. That music is from an event at Harlem's Apollo Theater, gospel performance by Marcel Davies Lashley, part of WNYC and the Apollo Theater's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebration. And here are some of those words from Martin Luther King's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech back in 1964.
Old systems of exploitation and oppression are passing away, and out of the wombs of the frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. Doors of opportunity are gradually being opened to those at the bottom of society, the shirtless and barefoot people of the land, are developing a new sense of somebodiness and carving a tunnel of hope through the dark mountain of despair.
So on a weekend for remembering the heroes of the civil rights movement, our new president-elect chose to dump on one of the heroes who marched with Dr. King in Selma, Congressman John Lewis. In a trusty early morning Saturday tweet, Congressman John Lewis should spend more time on fixing and helping his district, which is in horrible shape and falling apart, not to mention crime-infested, rather than falsely complaining about the election results. All talk, 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 no action or results. Sad. Now, we should note that Lewis's district has a Ritz-Carlton Hotel in it, the headquarters of Coca-Cola in it, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in it, Emory University, a crime rate well below the national average, and an unemployment rate below the national average as well. In short, I guess it's an urban hell. We should also note that Trump was reacting to some bitter comments that Congressman Lewis made during a Friday taping of Meet the Press.
I don't see this president-elect as a legitimate president.
You do not consider him a legitimate president. Why is that?
I think the Russians participated in helping this man get elected, and they helped destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton.
Well, the principal effect of this tweet spat was to cause all of John Lewis's books to reportedly sell out and for African-American members of Congress to speculate that the next 4 years will be more racially divided than ever before. It would appear that Trump considers Lewis something of a sacred cow like John McCain and is signaling a new attitude towards the icons of Capitol Hill. President-elect Trump did eventually make remarks about the plight of African-Americans in history, but the main point lingered. Is progress possible? Has progress over the last 8 years been enough? The most tangible area of needed reform may be in the prison population, where 2.2 million adults are in state or federal prisons. And criminal justice reform has been a top priority for the Obama administration. But has it been more than just incremental? Glenn E. Martin served 6 years in a New York state prison. Today, he's the president and founder of Just Leadership USA, an organization dedicated to cutting the U.S. correction population in half by the year 2030, which would include considering release of more than just nonviolent offenders.
The question is whether or not he created an environment for additional reform. I would argue he has. He issued HUD regulations to landlords saying that barring formerly incarcerated people from access to housing violates the Fair Housing Act. He changed the regulations around child support so that people don't come home from prison owing $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in child support arrears. He banned the box on federal job applications so that formerly incarcerated job seekers have a chance to fairly compete for jobs just like anyone else.
They don't have to notify, disclose in advance that they're
He commuted the sentence of over 1,300 people, more than the last 10 presidents combined. He banned solitary confinement for juveniles in the federal system. So there's a number of concrete things that we can actually point to. But again, I think
Just on those concrete things for a second, do you see those becoming precedents in the state system?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's the opposite of what happened here. I think that the appetite for doing things in D.C. around criminal justice reform actually came from a decade and a half of reform in both red and blue states around the country.
That's so interesting.
You know, that actually created a pretty safe environment for things to be happening in D.C., not as much as we all would have liked. But at the same time, you know, we have a new president coming in, and there's a question of whether we'll get anything done in D.C. That's a legitimate question to ask, but I would remind people that it was the states and local municipalities that decided we can just no longer do this. We can't afford it. $80 billion a year to run prisons with the type of abysmal outcomes that we're achieving would inspire both ends of the political spectrum to say we have to do something different.
Do you see the momentum of what's happened over the last 8 years continuing?
Yeah, the question is whether or not it's the momentum we should pay attention to or the redefining of the narrative. You know, and here's where I give the Obama administration a lot of credit. It's one thing to commute to sentences of 1,300 people. That's a drop in the bucket. There's 9,000 applications for pardons and commutations. So it's a drop in the bucket. Having said that, having breakfast with people after you commute their sentence and inviting the press to come along, that is the sort of impact I think we may not be able to measure today, but one day we'll look back and realize it was actually a turning point.
So you think the visit to the prison that he actually did was one of the bigger impacts?
Look, we have a criminal justice system that operates on punitiveness and retribution. And yet, if you ask most people, what does our correctional system do? They talk about rehabilitation and reform and transformation and redemption. Those things no longer exist in our criminal justice system. Why? Because we've dehumanized the 70 million Americans that now have a criminal record on file, the 2.3 million Americans in prison on any given day. And so therefore, if they're not human, then we don't have to treat them like human beings. I think what the Obama administration did was to remind us that we're all fallible and that, yes, people end up in prison for making bad decisions, but that we're all human. And I think that opened up a space for people to at least start listening and paying attention. I've been doing this for a decade and a half since I exited prison myself after serving 6 years. And I got to tell you, I mean, today, you know, usually I just have to open my mouth and say I do criminal justice reform these days and people jump right in and they
really
fill the void. Whereas 5 years ago,
people
10 years
talk.
Ago, I felt like a tree in the forest. I felt as though no one was listening.
From your perspective, did the Obama administration see limits that they weren't going to confront, they weren't going to cross?
I don't think Congress was willing to hand this president a win on just about anything, even criminal justice reform, where there's actually bipartisan consensus on the need to do something. You know, that also makes me hopeful, actually, the fact that now this black president isn't in the way. People don't have to hand a win to this charismatic, relatively effective black president. And so now the hope is that there's actually a chance for not just for a bill to pass in Congress, for it to be a more meaningful bill than some of the meaningful distractions that are languishing in Congress right now. Maybe there's a chance now for Congress to come together and get something done. I would argue that the Republicans are going to want to show that the gridlock is going away, and here's a place where they can not just show that, but also work on an issue that doesn't just impact poor people of color in this country. There are many poor white Americans, the same folks that voted our president-elect into office, who would be positively impacted by us rolling back our archaic tough-on-crime policies.
Donald Trump says he's a law and order president. Is that rhetoric, or does that get in the way of the changes that you said a moment ago you were hopeful about?
I do think that rhetoric from the president can potentially roll back some of the gains that we've made over the last 8 years in particular. Having said that, there is a constituency that exists now around reform that isn't easily turned around. You know, because Obama created space for reform, because we have almost two decades now of local level reform, you actually have a pretty large constituency to push back on anything that doesn't line up with reality. So we have a criminal justice system that was built without the benefit of data and research, mostly fear-driven, mostly as a response to other failed policies, whether it be health care, workforce development, economic development, and so on. But now, over the last decade in particular, because the Obama administration actually opened a door for this conversation, because even the Bush administration started this conversation, there's a tremendous amount of data, there's a tremendous amount of research that has happened. And so, for instance, the president keeps banging away at this idea that violent crime is up in this country. That's absolutely untrue. Over the last two decades, violent crime has been down considerably. Here in New York, where, you know, when I was on Rikers Island 20 years ago, there were 23,000 people. Today we have 8,000 people there. And yet serious crime in New York is down at rates comparable to 1961. And that's reflected all across this country.
Well, then, since you bring up data, the Brennan Center says that 70% of the people in prison today constitute no significant threat to communities should they be released tomorrow.
So I think this is one of the biggest barriers to meaningful criminal justice reform, what you just brought up, this bifurcation of the population between violent and nonviolent. First of all, the way we went from here in New York, for instance, 12,000 people in our prisons to over 72,000 in 1992, and now we're stuck around 56,000, wasn't just because we ratcheted up punishment for nonviolent first-time offenders. We actually ratcheted up punishment for everyone. And now we have all of this data that says that lengthier sentences actually give us negative outcomes. The fact that there's like the law of diminishing returns. The longer a person stays in prison, the less chance they have of being successful once they're released. And yet we continue to do what feels politically palatable for us. And our president is guilty of that. When I met with President Obama and I had a chance to talk to him, one of the three things, one of my three talking points was specifically about him being careful not to continue to bifurcate the population. And obviously he continued to keep doing that.
What did he say? What did he say to you?
He said, look, you know, I get this. I understand this. But we have to see what we can accomplish now and then build on top of that.
Well, so what do you say? A lot of African-Americans, when Obama was giving his inaugural speech, said in their heart of hearts, I was thinking, don't go too far. You're going to get shot. What do you say to the argument, hey, come on, Glenn, you can't push too far here?
You know, I'll say this. As someone directly impacted by the system, as someone who spent 6 years in prison and realized that we lock up some of America's best and brightest, you know, I'll point to Rockefeller drug law reform here in New York. We banged away at that for 36 years. We finally had a huge win in 2009 where we got rid of 95% of our mandatory minimum drug laws. The reason we filled up our prisons with people who should have been diverted to treatment. And we won partially because we kept telling the legislature these are nonviolent offenders. They don't belong there. The problem with that message is that it's a double-edged sword. What's behind that message is the implicit message that everyone else does belong there. And so again, you know, the question is, do you want to win the war or do you want to win the battle? And pushing for nonviolent offenders to get out. And, you know, Hillary Clinton standing there saying, yes, we got to end mass incarceration by getting these nonviolent marijuana offenders out of prison. That is a joke. That low-hanging fruit has been gone a long time ago. We have to be willing to dig deeper.
What would you advise the president in a quiet moment that he should do that would help to continue the positives that you see, incomplete as they are?
I think that post-presidency, our president is going to maintain the momentum he's been able to build, the amount of access to press that he's held over the last 8 years. And I truly believe that he has to continue to create ways to humanize people who are involved in our criminal justice system. The reason we criminalize poverty and mental health and addiction and homelessness and you name it is because we have dehumanized people who are in the system. Our president has a way of doing what a very limited number of privileged Americans have done in the past, which is to recognize their privilege and align it alongside people who don't have as much privilege to help share a message about the humanity of those folks. And I think that there are some concrete policy things he can work on. Obviously, we've only been doing this for 4.5 decades. It's very clear how we got here. Mandatory minimums, truth in sentencing, three strikes laws, prison privatization. But none of those things happen if we think of people in the system as less than human.
Glenn E. Martin, president and founder of Just Leadership USA. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by answering the question that's on everyone's mind. Yes, this is real life. This is really happening. On January 20th, I, Donald J. Trump, will become the 45th president of the United States. And then 2 months later, Mike Pence will become the 46th.
Is Alec Baldwin having the time of his life as Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live? The stage screen actor and writer may be worried enough about being pegged as Trump forever that he told me last week it took some secret Jedi mind magic by Saturday Night Live's Lorne Michaels to get Baldwin to do some Trump sketches during the campaign. But when Trump won the election, the Jedi magic felt more like the dark force for this longtime political activist. When we spoke to him last week, he was happy to share his formula for impersonating Trump. And maybe it's because he's anxious for someone to take over what has become his duty to his country.
So the key to the Trump impersonation is that you talk like this, and you raise one eyebrow, drop the other, and then you say, let me just tell you about Jeff Sessions. He is a fantastic guy, amazing. So we always default to fantastic, amazing, terrific. There's always that pause, and he never comes up with anything stronger or clearer. You ask him about the environment. The EPA is out of control, and what we need to do is bring in some really fantastic people who can fix this. You know, he's not a great thinker, and he demonstrates that over and over again. It's kind of harrowing, actually.
It's chilling to listen to that, quite frankly, I have to say. Do people in entertainment and Hollywood, for lack of a better term, exist in a bubble, politically speaking? And if you looked at the Golden Globes the other night, you could blink and think to yourself, man, this is a kind of clubby atmosphere. They're definitely not talking to the people in rural America at the strip malls.
The politics of the average person who works in the entertainment industry, whether they be actors on screen or they're musicians who perform, you know, and so forth, writers, directors, I mean, there's a whole myriad of those people. I think that those people, they tend to lean that way because they have a conscience. They make pretty good money, some of them, but not all of them, and they have a conscience which tells them, I want to do well, but I want to do good. And you have a Republican Party who's been telling people for many, many years, don't worry so much about doing good. Let's get you to do well first. Worry about you. Worry about your wallet. Vote your wallet. Vote your concerns. And I find that the artist community that I work within, I mean, I'm not friends with all these people. I get these comments all the time online and people on Twitter saying, you know, why don't you shut up about your criticisms of the oil industry? What do you fuel your private plane with? I can count on both hands how many times I've flown on a private plane. I've flown commercial nearly 99.99999% of my life. These assumptions of how I live, what my lifestyle live, they're erroneous and they're offensive. The community of artists that I count myself among are A, very caring people, and for the most part, very informed people. And they wind up ending up on the side of something which is more, I'd say, about doing good as much as doing well.
Do you like being politically active? Is it consistent with your artistic vision, or does it get in the way?
I like it to some degree, but I mean, once Obama won, I did. I'm writing my memoir now, which is coming on out in April, and I did confess to the idea that once Obama won, I was guilty. And this is also, I think, a sign of my age as well, where I sat there and I go, well, our guy's in, we're good. And I kind of backed off and wasn't really that involved and that concerned. I thought Obama's got everything covered.
Mistake.
And it was a mistake. I mean, not that I have a lot of complaints about Obama. I have some. But I will say that my personal view of the presidency and what the president can and can't do and how that man or woman in the future would operate is a very particular picture of what the president really can do and can't do, and what kind of systems he walks into that are already in place and aren't going to change in terms of the military and foreign policy and so forth. And having said that, I think that Obama, when he leaves, I'm sorry to see him leave because he operated fairly well with inside those systems. He made some mistakes, I think. I think he should have closed Guantanamo as a symbol to the rest of the world about where we're at. But at the same time, I think Obama was just as elegant and as thoughtful and as gracious a person. And then I think that counts for something. Because now we have somebody who's like the villain in a W.C. Fields movie as the president of the United States. So,
what would you like to change? What job would you want to have?
Politically.
What do you want to try once?
Or what job do I want in life?
Any of those
or
things.
In politics? Just
anything. Politics, anything.
Or in politics. Well, I mean, obviously, I think people, you want to be the president of the United States because you want to lead people toward where you think that they're better served going. I would tell people, don't be afraid. Let's have I don't want to say Manhattan Project because that bespeaks some kind of military operation. I want to say let's have the Apollo Project of alternative energy. Just as we said that, just as Kennedy said, we will put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. I want to say by the end of the decade, we will have a 50% goal. We will meet 50% of our energy needs. I mean, I have friends of mine who say you can put derricks on the Great Lakes with wind turbines there, and absent the issue of animal strike and things like that, which is a very serious thing, you can put derricks out on the Great Lakes and power one-third of the country with those derricks.
I wish you could see your eyes light up when you talk about this, because I get this impression that for you know, since you were like 4 years old, you've been looking at the TV, seeing the political figures in America and going, I could do that. Is that right?
I have been.
Is that true?
Well, that's changed in recent years, but I wouldn't ever run because I know I wouldn't win because we live in these very, very strident times right now. So, I mean, I would be the right wing's poster boy. They'd be salivating if I ran.
A sign off from the Trump character who you channel. What does he think about public radio? What's his sense of
what's not fake news? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't have Tina here to write for me, so I'm in a bind. I need a writer all the time. But I wonder if he would. I wonder what.
What's he going to do about fake news? He's going to bring somebody in. What's he going to do about it?
He's going to start Trump TV with Jared. They're going to start their own network and fill it with journalists that are really just fantastic journalists, great journalists, people who have wonderful credentials, and get them on TV and get them on the radio. Then we can really talk seriously about our political futures.
It's been fantastic talking to you.
And John, you would not be one of those people. You're socialist. You're troublemaker. Fake news. Fake news. Hockenberry. Hockenberry is German for fake news.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Actor Alec Baldwin, who said he'll stop doing the impersonation of Donald Trump, which Trump spokesman Sean Spicer has called mean-spirited, when the president-elect releases his tax returns.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Secretary of State John Kerry is taking his final trips this week with a visit to Paris over the weekend for Middle East peace talks, as well as a final visit to London today to meet with his UK counterpart, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. The most traveled U.S. Secretary of State has very little to show for his efforts, really. His passionate support for the Law of the Sea Treaty came to nothing in the end. A global treaty on disability rights could not make it through the U.S. Senate. There's the persistent Syrian war. The Arab-Israeli conflict is as divided as ever. Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC, says Kerry's vast diplomatic experience may be of limited value at a get-acquainted meeting a few days before the changing of the guard in Washington, D.C.
I think if one looks at Mr. Kerry's tenure, I think certainly viewed from this side of the Atlantic, one would say he gets extraordinary marks for devotion, for duty, for resilience, for making that extra effort in virtually every dossier that he's had to deal with. But if you look at the wider report card, the United States pretty well sidelined now in the whole Syria situation, tensions and problems with many of America's erstwhile allies in the region who felt that perhaps the Obama administration was a little bit hands-off or wasn't there front and centre when they were needed. The reset to Asia, obviously an awful lot, or the pivot to Asia, an awful lot of effort put in there, but in a sense, America continually being pulled back to these concerns, traditional concerns in the Middle East. Obviously, the Atlantic Alliance, strong measure against Russia. Yes, I think that has been better terrain for the administration. But of course, all of that now to some extent in question with the arrival of the Trump team into power in just a few days' time.
Well, certainly the Russia business is going to be completely revamped under Trump on some level. And I don't know what Kerry is going to say there. The pivot to Asia, a lot of talk there. And I think Kerry was interested in it. But I think the limits that Barack Obama put on this, or his lack of focus on Asia, meant that, I mean, in the end, I couldn't make head nor tails of the policy implications of this so-called pivot to Asia. The Middle East, I think John Kerry made a valiant effort to get settlements off the table as a way of moving forward on Arab-Israeli peace. But in the end, I don't think anyone was going to stake any capital on it, certainly not Barack Obama. The sources that I talk with say that it was the passion, the individual personal passion of John Kerry that made that Iran deal work. And that is a signature sort of achievement of John Kerry. And I don't know if that jives with the people that you speak with.
No, I think that is a very fair point. I mean, as you say, on the Israel-Palestinian peace part of the policy spectrum, nobody made a more valiant effort than John Kerry. Clearly, it was not felt in the White House that the moment was ripe to make the sort of political, dispense the political capital or diplomatic capital that might be needed. I think, frankly, that was probably correct. I don't think there's any indication that Israelis or Palestinians are on the threshold of any kind of agreement or even any real desire to restart a proper and meaningful peace process. So I think to some extent, again, it was, you know, hugely effort on the part of Mr. Kerry, but for very limited results. And of course, the administration ends with the decision not to oppose this resolution at the UN Security Council, which, you know, leaves a difficult legacy, whether people believe that it was the right thing to do or not. I think the Iran deal is an important achievement, and I think it's probably an achievement that is going to stand the test of time. I think it's going to be very difficult for the new US administration to unpick that. I think the problem, amongst other things, is that there's another side to all of this, and that's the Iranian side. Obviously, there are important political changes coming up this year in Iran as well. I think this deal is inevitably going to be part of the internal political manoeuvring in Tehran. And of course, the only levers that the US has are sanctions. And as everybody has pointed out, sanctions just enacted by the United States itself are not particularly meaningful. They have to have their allies alongside them. So I think that deal may, in the end, turn out to be one of the abiding legacies of Mr. Kerry's tenure.
Kerry does go back to the Cold War in his, you know, experience in Vietnam, and then his long-standing experience in Congress. Maybe he's got some insights for Boris Johnson if indeed Trump decides to go back to some sort of Cold War Russia-U.S. détente in this new regime.
Well, I think clearly if there were genuine détente, which suggests a fundamental understanding between Moscow and Washington of where each side is coming from and where each side's red lines actually are, that mightn't be a bad thing. I think the problem is that clearly, leaving aside all of the dramatic revelations or non-revelations, dossiers which may or may not be untrue in whole or in part or whatever, the fact is that Mr. Trump's comments about Russia are worrying for its European allies. They're particularly worrying for countries like Poland and the Baltic Republics, who have seen what's gone on in Ukraine and worry that they might be in the Russian firing line next, or at least at some point in the future. You, of course, have this extraordinary coda, if you like, to the Obama administration, the deployment of this US armored brigade in Poland. Only just a few days ago, its tanks began arriving on the ground in Poland. Now, is Mr. Trump going to undo these kind of reassurance measures? I think it would be really difficult to see in an administration with so many former generals, NATO really being the bugbear, as Mr. Trump says. He believes it's obsolete in one form or another. I think it would be hard to see him following through on that. Clearly, the hope is that some of the more extraordinary comments made by Mr. Trump will not be enacted into policy.
Lots to think about here in 2017. Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Dolly Madison made the White House a monument to good taste. Bill Clinton rented it out for cash. Jackie Kennedy made the White House the Castle of Camelot. Benjamin Harrison gave electricity to the White House but was too scared to touch the switches. All presidents since Franklin Pierce benefited from the first bathtub he installed at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But on this MLK Day, Takeaway culture reporter Melissa Locker notes that the first African-American president's achievement over the last 8 years may tower over all of these. Obama, she says, made the White House cool.
He kind of was operating not only as the commander-in-chief, but as a, you know, cultural touchstone. He was really setting up a very, very high bar for who he listened to, who he asked to play. And he just managed to kind of infuse the entire White House with coolness.
Let's branch that out and explore how he actually turned the White House into a venue.
Well, I think like way before the playlist, even at his inauguration back in 2009, he had Beyonce singing Etta James at last. And I mean, once you start there, I mean, it's the fact that he could even meet that again is pretty hard.
Land, my love has come
What about his use of the White House for making an artistic statement?
Yeah, well, like in 2009, he had a White House poetry jam. Lin-Manuel Miranda introduced a few bars of something that would go on to become Hamilton.
Have you seen the video of that?
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's totally amazing. It is completely amazing. And boy, that White House and that room seems very cool. And the world is gonna know your name. What's your name, man? Alexander Hamilton. His name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things he hasn't done. And Michelle Obama calls it the best art of any kind that she's ever experienced.
Michelle Obama has been really involved in making the White House cool, too, because don't forget that at South by Southwest in 2015, she unveiled her charity single, This Is For My Girls, with this lineup of women that just is jaw-dropping. There's Missy Elliott and Kelly Clarkson and Zendaya. It is amazing.
Can this be topped, or is this the high bar here for making the White House a pop cultural venue?
Man, it is going to be hard to top this. But I think that, you know, Barack Obama theoretically could go on to continue his role. Spotify has offered him a job. Well, they've offered him the chance to apply for a job as president of playlists. He is
really
uniquely qualified for the position, not only because he has been putting out these incredible playlists for a few years, but because the job requirement also requires a Nobel Prize and, you know, time running a major nation. I'm going to apply, but I'm not sure if my Nobel Prize in, you know, jewelry making is going to cut it.
So in terms of playlists, what about Barack Obama's playlists convey really the depth of his coolness?
Okay, so first of all, everyone in the White House around him swears that he handpicks these playlists, which is kind of amazing because there are some artists on the list that even I have not heard of.
Even Melissa Locker has not heard of.
Right, and like I write about music professionally, and he apparently just has this incredible taste. So his art.
If you're the president, you can get anything you want.
Well, yeah, and so you can have everything from like Leon Bridges to Prince and Nina Simone. And, you know, he's mixing Aaron Neville and D'Angelo. Like, he's amazing. I want them to know my name. You're my lady.
How will he stay engaged? And do you think he will stay engaged and be engaged in this sort of cultural narrative?
I can't imagine that he's going to step back from that just because he's already said that he wants to have a role kind of helping to lead and guide the people. And I think, you know, the celebrities haven't really been signing on board with Donald Trump, so maybe they will continue to stand by the side of Barack Obama.
Melissa Locker, cultural reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As one of his gestures in the days leading up to the end of his term, President Obama proclaimed three historic civil rights sites as national monuments. The Birmingham Civil Rights Monument in Birmingham, which includes the 16th Street Baptist Church, where four black girls were killed by a bomb set off by a white supremacist. The Freedom Riders National Monument in Anniston, Alabama, where in 1961 they were attacked by white segregationists who firebombed a bus. And the Reconstruction-era National Monument in Beaufort County, South Carolina, which includes one of the first schools for freed slaves. The Obama administration, like the nation, has come late to the realization that a vast period of history from Reconstruction to the Jim Crow era to the Black Lives Matter movement of our time has yet to be fully understood. Khalil Muhammad is director emeritus of the newly honored Schomburg Center in Harlem and professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He says this new appreciation of history is critical.
The simple fact that we've never actually acknowledged through a national monument the story of Reconstruction robs us of the most significant constitutional revolution this country has experienced since the founding of the nation, gave us the actual infrastructure of citizenship that we depend upon today.
The recognition of the Jim Crow period and its violence and really literally terrorism is something that happened late in the Obama administration. I think it's as though the president began thinking that this was going to be a sort of business as usual, incremental realization. And with the police brutality that happened and the Black Lives Matter movement, all of a sudden, the camera lens went much wider on history. And if you look at the African-American History Museum, there's a tremendous focus on the Reconstruction era and Jim Crow.
I think, as has been true in times past, social movements have a significant impact on both how we reinterpret the past, but also our contemporary politics, the very way in which we redefine what justice is. And so we owe a lot of credit to the activists of the past several years, particularly since the Occupy movement and then with Black Lives Matter, in forcing us as a nation, and more particularly our museums and political leaders, to be more honest about the difficulty and the fragile nature of racial progress in America.
He said in his farewell speech that whites need to understand that impulses to commemorate some of the monuments that have been commemorated and impulses to embrace the Black Lives Matter movement aren't a form of reverse racism, but are a recognition of how this time has been omitted from our history. How do you think these monuments and more to come will help to rectify that?
Well, just as is true with the King Monument on the Mall, there's a way in which the grandeur of the physicality of history is incredibly important for all ages to have an introduction to the past. The fact that we are now 150 years later, really just beginning the work of building museums and monuments to our Black past, is testament to this struggle, but also an invitation now, finally, to a reconciliation that is long overdue.
How can whites participate in that reconciliation by getting involved and having a meaningful connection to these monuments?
Well, first they have to acknowledge their legitimacy. People have to take on the responsibility and burden. As Dr. King, whom we honor today, said, white Americans have a greater responsibility for ending their own racial ignorance than any responsibility blacks have for having suffered from that past. And these monuments are a perfect moment for building the unfinished work that remains. In a post-Obama world, just like a post-Reconstruction world, in many ways, we are starting backwards. We are starting at a lower point than where we've come from. And with monuments, with museums, with commitment in our classrooms, we can protect ourselves from slipping backwards. As Obama himself said in a farewell speech, oftentimes we take two steps forward and one step backwards. Well, please, let's hope that in this moment, and let's do the work that we don't have to move backwards again.
Khalil Muhammad is Director Emeritus of the Schomburg Center and Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He spoke with us today from Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, where it is very chilly. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
With a civil rights hero, Congressman John Lewis, publicly sparring with a self-made white billionaire, President-elect Donald Trump, it would appear as though the next 4 years may be filled with racial tension. President Obama's approval rating at 55% as he leaves office, while Donald Trump's favorability ratings are at historic lows for an incoming president, suggest African-American leaders have called Trump's election a triumph of white supremacy. But the numbers also suggest that African-Americans, while claiming little affection for Donald Trump, are also losing patience with the Democratic Party. Listen to hardworking Louisiana contractor Trey Narcisse, who was on our show back in November.
The 8 years Barack Obama was in office, it didn't really affect my living status. I affected my living status more than he did. So I didn't see a valuable candidate this year, just like I didn't see when Barack Obama was running, so I didn't vote.
Trey was happy to tell us that while he voted for all his local offices, he simply ignored the presidential races. For Cornell Belcher, data points like this suggest that old arguments that divide are losing their potency. Belcher is the author of A Black Man in the White House and was a lead pollster for the Democratic National Committee under Howard Dean. He was also a member of President Obama's polling team for both the 2008 and 2012 campaigns. On a historic day for racial reflection, Belcher and Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick had a conversation about how the old rules of fear-based politics are returning, but with unexpected parallels to 40 and 50 years ago.
I've been having conversations with my friends and family members in a way that we've never had conversations about race and actual fear. And conversations about how, you know, we feel now connected to our grandfathers in a way that is surprising to us in that we are actually fearful about being black people walking around America. From an electoral standpoint, I'm not surprised by this. In fact, my book foretold this, that there would be, in fact, a backlash to Barack Obama's presidency in real racial terms. And when you see the rise of Donald Trump, a George Wallace-like figure, I'd argue that Barack Obama's presidency and, in fact, the diverse coalition that put him in that office was a triggering effect that allowed a very racially polarizing figure like Donald Trump to rise to prominence.
So let's talk about the numbers. You're a pollster. Pollsters like graphs. You like pictures, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
We have to do everything in our numbers and pretty pictures now for people.
So there's a picture, of an ugly picture,
okay,
in your book labeled racial aversion over time in America. And I think maybe this particular picture has a lot to do with what you're talking about. It's full of math, but what does it show?
I started tracking racial aversion going back in the spring of 2008. And so we started monitoring racial aversion over time. And what our polling over the last 12 years, right, in fact, shows that racial aversion has increased, particularly among sort of conservatives and Republicans. What is clear in the data is that particularly spiked at the perfect time for Donald Trump. Donald Trump has taken advantage of a perfect, anxious racial storm in America.
And not just over the last year of the campaign. I mean, Donald Trump's entire political rise was based on him staying in the news with birtherism.
Well, that's absolutely right. And look, to a certain extent, Donald Trump just rebooted the Southern Strategy, right? And the Southern Strategy, which is a famous strategy, Nixon, Atwater, that was really about pitting one group against the other. It was really about pitting working class whites versus African Americans, right? And no, this is not me. This is history. Donald Trump basically rebooted the Southern Strategy. And instead of just the African American, he added the Mexican and the Muslim, these brown hordes at the gates. He took it perfect advantage of when people say they want their country back, we should understand what they're saying. They think they're losing their country. I'm not saying that's a bad or a good thing, but what I'm saying is that's a real thing. And if we play the zero sum racial group game, I think America loses long term because we're not going to become more white. You know, we you know, demographics are destiny. We are a browning country. And if we play a zero-sum game where we can't share power, we lose democracy.
You say in your book that you believe that race is the grand political organizing principle in America now. It made me think of the large number of Trump supporters in a place like Pennsylvania. I spent a lot of time during the election, Republicans and Trump supporters who knew that racial tensions were higher, who, when I asked them, are you signing on to vilification of Mexicans and Muslims? And they would say, I had great hopes when Obama won that we would be in a racially better place. And they would say that from their perspective in rural Pennsylvania, that the black president had failed to improve race relations in their eyes.
Look, there's a lot of research by people in academics that show that when one group feels threatened and one group feels as though they're losing and there's tension, they will pull in and there is more nationalism. Barack Obama didn't do anything from a policy standpoint or from a governing standpoint to increase racial tension. I mean, most people of color would actually argue that he did everything he could to lessen that tension. I mean, from a policy standpoint, what did he do, in fact, that would make white conservatives hate him other than being black? Let's be real. The day before his election, Republicans did something that they hadn't, quite frankly, done before. They gathered together in a steakhouse in Washington, D.C., and decided that they were going to block everything he did, in fact, to make him a failed president. The level of disrespect and the level of just outside the norm stuff that you saw over the last 8 years is because a black man is in the White House. We've had a Congress that has worked through national disasters, through wars, through whatever you throw at it. But the moment we have a black man in the White House, it becomes a completely dysfunctional body in a way that it has never been before. All of a sudden, we are acting in ways that we all know are outside the norms, and we're trying to stop people from voting. We're trying to disenfranchise people, and we're playing the zero-sum game that the moment that black and brown people gain political power, white people lose political power, which has been part of the conflict of America dating back for centuries.
I want to step back for a minute and ask you to bring us inside the room, if you would, with Barack Obama. When you're the pollster and you're briefing him, the election is coming up. We all know he's competitive, and he's shown he likes to win, that he needs to win. So what are those conversations like when he's strategizing and giving marching orders?
You know, I'm not one who likes to talk a lot about clients and people I work for.
His political career's done. Come on. He won't mind.
You know, my interactions with then-Senator Obama in 2008, you know, were everything that made me believe in politics again, because he was someone who had a core set of beliefs. And one of the first times I sat around a table with him before he decided to run and he talked about building a movement, I mean, it's almost religious, right? Especially for people of color, movements aren't just about politics. Movements are larger. They're about culture. They're about who we are. They are so many things. And this idea that we're going to build a movement for change and we're going to expand the electorate, he was authentic about that and a genuinely good person. There was never a moment where you thought, this is someone who's inauthentic, which you get from so many other politicians these days. And I think we Democrats are going to miss that.
Cornell Belcher was a member of President Obama's polling team for both the 2008 and 2012 campaigns. He's the author of A Black Man in the White House, and he spoke to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick.
This is Jim Curry calling from Delaware, Ohio. And I think the greatest civil rights challenge of our day is actually the broad recognition and acceptance of the fact that there are civil rights challenges.
What would you say to that? South Grafton, Georgia, the assault on truth is our greatest challenge. How can we prevail against any discrimination or oppression if the very concept of truth is called into question and is seemingly disregarded by so many? Thanks so much for listening on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.